This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 2nd of June, 2023. Markets, a very interesting session yesterday because we have the Senate also signing on this debt ceiling deal. And obviously Biden will sign this as well, I assume today. And this issue is cleared. And as we've been trumpeting and many others have been also discussing, there is a concern about the liquidity situation as the Treasury rebuilds its account. We'll work through that. I just think it's a bit ironic that when this does clear, we see sort of risk on almost across the board, really across the board, actually, entirely, and also Treasury yields coming in lower, sort of a by the fact, if you will, on risk to this situation. So in short, slide two, you can see the S&P 500 closing in a new high for the cycle. The intraday didn't reach the new high, but the high was on the close was the highest close since last, I believe it's August for the S&P of the NASDAQ since last April. So well over a year there. You can see from the Saxo equity theme baskets that this has been a very broad rally yesterday. And on the flip side of this, the only thing weakening here really is the U.S. dollar. Again, is this a sell the fact reaction to the lifting of the debt ceiling issue? The jury is out. Certainly, if yields do continue to come lower, and as I think Althea will focus on in her discussion of bonds, especially if the longer-term yields come in lower, dollar-yen will be a big focus here. And as I put in the slide three on the dollar-yen chart, this sort of 138, sub-138 area down to the 200-day moving average, which is in the low 137s, we're working down through that, you've effectively reversed that chart and you have a more structurally bearish setup. Noticing on the FX board, the huge shift in momentum to the downside in the dollar. Still have the Noki and the Stocky, so the Scandis struggling a bit here, but they are trying to reverse quite valiantly versus the euro. And I think if this risk on trade extends, those will be some pretty, there could be some pretty hefty volatility to the upside for those if there's a sentiment shift on what has been an incredible sell-off. Among commodity currencies, as we'll talk about in commodities, the Canadian dollar rallying quite strongly and really leading the pack there. We've seen a big bounce back in oil, and I'm sure Ole will discuss that. But moving quickly, and then we're going to wrap some of our user questions or listener questions into today's discussion, because Althea, you had a question on the Treasury General Account and its rebuilding and the liquidity issues. And so you've broken a lot of this down for us. It's a really cool overview here, starting on slide four. So take us through that.
Yes, John. So on slide four, we have on the left-hand side the 3 months change in outstanding Treasury bills. So basically what shows you is that as per the Treasury quarterly announcement, the Treasury has to sell... as to raise by the end of June around $480 billion. That's the net issuance. But what happens then to all those maturity, like securities that are maturing, that needs to be refinanced? So basically, when we talk that there is going to be a massive issuance in the upcoming weeks, what we are talking about is around $500 billion in gross terms, which includes the net debt issuance together with the refinancing of existing maturity. And the big question, and that's the chart that you see on the right-hand side, is who is going to pick up all these T-bills? And it can be either bank deposits, the bank's reserve balances that we see there, or the money market funds that have cash at the reverse repo facility. And the big take out of that chart is that if it's deposit taking these incredibly high issuance of T-bills, then we might find ourselves in a situation similar to the one of March. If it's money markets, then everything should go smoothly. But it's a very fine line, John. And I believe that the answer to that question lies within the yield at which these securities will be marketable. because in order to appeal to a money market fund, they have to offer a rate above the reverse repo facility, which at the moment is paying 5.05%.
All right. And then as you will discuss in a moment, and I just wanted to bring you in, Ole, because we had a little discussion on this, on the positioning in the futures market on these US Treasury futures, and parts of the curve are at these record shorts. I'm not sure which of the speculative measures or slices you've looked at. So the pain trade here, certainly for the middle, medium sort of belly of the curve and further out, would be actually for Treasuries to rally, positioning wise. Is that not true?
To a certain extent, John, there's no doubt that if we should have added the description, but right now we're seeing the basically a, as you mentioned, a record short held by money managers or hedge funds, leveraged accounts, and the long that goes with that short is held by asset managers, and the going is normally that asset managers they are not as price sensitive. They're real money buyers and holding positions, whereas the hedge fund community tends to be a lot less or a lot more price sensitive. But there's obviously more to the story than just them having a big outright short, because otherwise they would all be out of business, especially in recent years where they were net short throughout a drop in yield. So a lot of that is spread trading. So the pain is mostly. It's mostly going to be reflected by how the other side of the trade is doing, and that's obviously going to be interesting to watch. But just from looking at the numbers, it is a massive short, and they are price responsive. So it may trigger a reaction, and it may also indicate that some of the problems that we're discussing here has already been priced in, because short positions are already there in anticipation of some of these moves. So that potentially could put a dampener on the potential negative impact on bond prices and the direction of yields.
Yeah, so that would, yeah, sort of the pain trade being, I guess, I'll tell you, would you agree that is the pain trade for longer yields to fall here, or what are you looking at here on slide five?
Well, on slide five, I'm looking at how investors are positioning at the moment, and the picture is pretty clear. Basically, on the left-hand side, we see that direction daily 20 plus year Treasury bull, which is an ETF that uses 3 times leverage to gains on drops of the long part of the yield curve. Has more than double its size since the beginning of the year. So basically, investors are betting that the Fed hawkishness is coming to an end. And on the right-hand side, we see the opposite fund, the ProShares Ultra Short of 20-plus year treasuries, which gains if yields rises, they basically had outflows for around 240 million. So the big story here, John, is that the market is positioning for long-term rates to fall, and it's using leverage to do that. So if that trade is not going on that direction, the aftermath that we are going to see in markets might be much stronger than when we would we can imagine.
Okay, well, now I'm thoroughly confused, because it looks like futures traders are positioned for one thing, and some of these, I guess, more trading markets, arguably positioned for the opposite. So we'll see who wins out. I think it's remarkable, however, regardless, that you were meant to have this liquidity crunch with the announcement of the debt ceiling lifting.
Yeah, I
Of
think
course,
all.
the jury is out. I mean, we do it will take some weeks, many weeks, to rebuild the treasury. So it's not like we could draw a conclusion from one day's action. But I find it interesting, the news flow versus the market reaction. Ola, did you want to say something?
Yeah, just basically just concluding it's just absolutely a massive market with so many different interests
Yeah.
playing out. So obviously the sum of them all, we need to we'll see the net effect of in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, but John, if I just want to close this, I think that at this point it's much more significant what is doing the front part of the yield curve, so the 2 years, because now it's the 2 years treasuries are trading quite rich, And still, there is probably the risk of another Fed rate hike in July, even though now the market is not pricing it out entirely for July. So, going from here, we might see more downside than upside for US Treasuries, especially in the front part of the curve.
Yeah, the likelihood of a hike has dropped to about 25% for June, and less than half now for that July move. Or it's yeah, about half of a rate hike is priced slightly more for July. All right, and then at the front end, we've seen a huge drop on these latest inflation numbers. I'd say pricing of the ECB after some of the latest CPI data, especially that miss on this Eurozone CPI core yesterday. 5.6 was the previous figure. It was expected to drop only to 5.5. They hit a 5.3, so a pretty big miss there, and we've seen quite a correction lower. So you're saying that looks like on slide 6, you think it's getting a bit too aggressive on pricing them to ease off here.
Absolutely. In slide 6, I put the 2 years shuts graph, and what you can see is that yields drop considerably from the ECB terminal rate, which at the moment we don't know exactly what it is. The terminal rate now it's at 3.25%, but if the ECB is going to hike a couple of times more, is going to rise to 3.75. So basically, I just believe that the front part of the yield curve of the German yield curve looks too rich, and we might see yields resuming to rise as the ECB continue to hike, because we cannot forget that anyway, inflation is 3 times their target, so they have to deliver once or twice these rate hikes.
Right. Okay, a couple. We're going to go to a couple of more listener questions from our latest Saxo Market Call listeners survey, and I think actually I'll save a couple from Peter. He was kind enough to provide a couple of slides in his absence today, but I think I'll let him talk to it also because we have so much on today's pod that I think I'll leave it till maybe next Tuesday. Some questions on valuations and expected returns, especially on slide 7. You can have a look at those charts, by the way. And a couple later on AI valuation risk. We've talked a lot about that as well, these risks. And by the way, I think just talking about, is this going to be a bigger full-on risk on move here and the latest moves in AI? Just noting further down the list, actually, I'll get to that later. Let's go back to one question that was specifically for the FX space, just to get through the slide deck in order. On slide 8, we get a questioner, and this is a great question here, a listener asking, quote, "In the past, during risk-off moments, the dollar used to rally, among other reasons, because of the tightening in dollar funding. Since the global financial crisis, the Fed has swap lines with many central banks. Do you think that the dollar would still rally against the majors, as in previous cases, in the case we have another major risk-off move?" And I think it's a great question. I think there's mixed evidence on how much the so-called dollar smile is still a dollar smile. And a dollar smile, it's a sort of a well-known term among FX gurus, the idea that the dollar, the smile being the two sides of the smile, being dollar up when either A, the Fed is tightening and tightening just in general, but especially if it's tightening a lot, and that's what we saw in 2022, especially from late 2021 in anticipation of it and into 2022. We saw it back in 2018. We saw it back in 2014 and 15 as well. That seems to be the bigger pulley here on the smile. Now, on the opposite side, the other part of the dollar smile, dollar up scenario, is when there's huge risk off and there's a global scramble for funding and liquidity and safety. And what's the safest harbor, the most liquid harbor? And that would be dollars and US Treasuries. A little bit more mixed evidence of that. And we saw very, very, very brief sort of run into panic mode in 2020. Less evidence of it in early 2018, but then in late 2018, when the Fed was continuing to hike and we saw risk off, that's the problem. It was risk off, but it was also the Fed continuing to hike that was the real issue. So we don't have a clean look, I don't think, for quite some time on whether a more broad-based market decline that is not based on the Fed tightening will still see this dollar smile in action. I think it's a great question. My assumption is we'll see it to a degree, but you're right. The Fed does move so quickly to prevent these crises from providing and driving excessive contagion. So they could get short-circuited by overwhelming response. And particularly as that question deals with the majors, I think there's a risk that the dollar smile is maybe more of a dollar smirk. In other words, only one side of the smile works, although I think the other side would work versus less liquid currencies potentially in some future risk-off scenario. Yeah, and then rolling forward, a couple more questions. Also in Japan's equity market in terms of dividend yields. Ola, you have some thoughts on uranium, and I don't know if this is also linked to one of the Saxo Market Call listeners' questions.
Yes, indeed, and we've seen quite a significant jump this past couple of days across the uranium stock market sector. The U.S. Congress is putting forward a proposal to fast track deployment of new reactors, and that's really what the market, I think, is waiting for, because we are already now seeing quite a lot of expansion going on in Asia. U.S. has been on the slow side, and obviously Europe is still way behind. And this is a bit of a jolt to the market. So we've seen a company like Cameco in Canada is up more than 12% in the last 48 hours. It's hitting the highest levels in 12 years, and it just highlights a sector where which we believe fairly strongly in, being part of the solution, the green transformation solution, and this is obviously a step in the right direction, getting some more focus on that in the US as well.
All right, and the crude oil, it's really trying to bounce back here. It's got a little bit more to go for a good solid technical reversal, arguably. You've discussed a lot the situation with OPEC Plus. What are you looking for in terms of price action to cement for you that we've maybe put in a bottom, and this whole OPEC Plus, well, these developments, what's in the mix here?
Well, the next is most certainly the weekend meeting. Once again, I'm struggling really to see why on earth they're putting these meetings in on a weekend. I'm sure they have time to meet on during a workday. It's not as if they're having another day job that they have to attend to these ministers. Because really, the risk is when you come forward with a major announcement like they did on April 2nd over the weekend, you create a massive gap. You can see that in the chart here on slide 12. Back in early April, we had that massive gap up, and when you leave a gap like that in the market, there's one thing that's for certain: by that is the traders want to close it. So the positive impact of the price cut or the production cut back in April was basically ruined by the mistake of creating this surprise over a weekend where the market couldn't trade it. So you force longs in at too high levels, and you create a level from where short sellers felt comfortable to get back involved. And since the result of that has been quite a significant drop since then, and we're now trading in the 70s. What can they do? Well, there's been a lot of speculation this week. I think that the consensus is for no change. At the same time, we know that the Saudi oil minister has been ranting again, once again, against speculators, and for sure they would like to do something that could underpin prices. But at the same time, they're challenged by the fact that these voluntary production cuts they announced in April, really only being carried out by a few producers. You can see that in the inserts as well on slide 12. This is the monthly production survey from Bloomberg, which covers the month of May. And we can see that the GCC major producers, Saudi, UAE, Kuwait, they've all cut their production close to the dotted line, which is their current baseline or current quota, while some of the others have actually increased production, Iraq, Nigeria, Angola, because they're simply still producing below their agreed target. So that's basically reducing some of the impact of these cuts. So where does it leave us? I think we're going to see no change. I mean, OPEC have to trust their own analysts, and their expectations are still for a robust pickup in demand into the second half. So why cut now if they have to increase production later? At the same time, the cuts we saw last, which really only started to take effect this month, is simply too soon after one cut to instigate the next one, because you haven't seen the full impact of those cuts. And I think also there are signs that Russian production is starting to be challenged and starting to come down as per what they promised a couple of months back, that they were cut by 500,000 barrels on a daily basis. So overall, we're stuck in the 70s, and as you said, John, we need to do a lot of work here before we can talk about a recovery, and the minimum level we need to break back above is 80, so that's still quite a bit away.
All right, and the weaker dollar wouldn't help either. We did see a weaker dollar yesterday again. Could the irony be we see The dollar weakened here if we're set for a risk on rally. One of the key names in that, as I show on slide 13, I think would be one of the most speculated, if not the most speculated upon stock. I don't know if NVIDIA is actually taken over by some metrics, is Tesla. And just technically, I just have a little thought there on Tesla. Notice the next $15 or so of price action are quite important, that sort of pivot high. Your cup and handle type of technical setup there around that 215 plus line in the sand. And just that there's an AI angle as well on Tesla. And it's kind of interesting. So one of the gurus in the whole space, or at least former guru in some people's minds, but Cathie Wood of ARK Invest, who has been, you know, maybe a bit made fun of, and at least noted that her NVIDIA position was drawn down to zero ahead of this big explosion. And she said, look, NVIDIA, and arguably valuation-wise, she's right, is priced a bit what she called ahead of the curve at 25 times of expected revenue. She thinks that the superior play is Tesla and its AI angle. And she claims, and this is the really bold claim here, that by 2030, the total addressable autonomous mobility market is on the order of $8 to $10 trillion. This is a mind-boggling figure. They're talking about, let's say, nominal growth is still pretty solid in the next few years. At least 5 to 6% of global GDP is going to be in autonomous mobility revenue, and that Tesla, of course, in her mind, would be the leader in that. That's a pretty bold claim, but regardless, Tesla is post-bubble. Really, it went from 400 plus to around 100, so a 75% drop. You could argue that the Tesla bubble has popped. But we have rallied 100% here, and then whether this is going to extend, I think, is one of the key elements in this whole speculative space around what's going on in AI and just the animal spirits in general. A couple other news items. Broadcom, its shares were off despite guiding for a doubling of AI-related demand and revenue in the coming year. Lululemon really doing well with a huge gain after hours on good guidance and talking about opening 30 to 35 new stores. Most of them in China. And on that note, we have Trip.com reporting next week, as I show on the earnings overview. We'll have a better one available next week. Of course, that's an Asia-related travel name that's come off as we've been a bit disappointed with the quality of the Chinese recovery and reopening. But let's see what they're guiding for next week. Also, troubled EV maker NIO, at least troubled in terms of the stock, is also up next week on Friday. And then today it's non-farm payrolls day. Let's see what's going on there. We have plus 195K expected, and even if we continue to come in a bit below that, with the unemployment rate hitting a record low again for the cycle last month, and if it pops up to 3.5%, that's not raising any eyebrows, as that's expected. These NFPs can come in well below 200 for quite some time, and you still have a very, very tight market. It's going to need to drop well below 100 and do so for a few months to just to point to a labor market that is slackening. So there's that. And then we'll put on the macro calendar, you can see some of the items there on slide 15 that are up next week. The ISM services will be the first one of interest early next week. And then the week after next, of course, we have the FOMC. All right. I think that's a wrap for today. There's a lot to go through. We'll be back next Tuesday. Monday is a holiday here in Denmark, our last of our mini springtime holidays here in Denmark. But we'll be back on Tuesday with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.